Yhteistyössä Grafia sekä arkkitehtuurimuseo ja designmuseo.
Tuo ääni kertoo, että kuuntelet Helsinki Design Weeklyä. Kiitos paljon siitä. Helsinki Design Weekly on muotoilun ja arkkitehtuurin erikoisohjelma, jossa seuraavan 12 viikon ajan kutsutaan tunniksi studioon kaikista kiinnostavimpia luovia tekijöitä Helsingistä ja muualtakin. Kutsujana ja keskustelijana olen minä, Anni Korkman. Helsinki Design Weekly on kuultu Radio Helsingissä mun laskujen mukaan nyt noin 5 vuoden ajan, ja sehän tarkoittaa tietenkin sitä, että on aika pysähtyä, ehkä vähän tutkia tai arvioida, kehitellä, parantaa. Niin tulevissa jaksoissa me tullaankin keskittymään vähän aiempaa tiiviimmin yhteen vieraaseen kerrallaan. Tulevaisuudessakin siis opitaan suunnittelijoilta ja ajattelijoilta heidän prosesseistaan ja inspiraation lähteistään, mutta tavoitteena on tuoda mahdollisimman monipuolinen joukko kiinnostavia hahmoja studioon. Ja kerro muuten, jos sulle tulee mieleen joku, joka olisi ehdottomasti kutsuttava studioon, katsotaan mitä mä voin tehdä. Jatkossakin siis Helsinki Design Weekly pyrkii kaikin tavoin tuomaan näkyväksi sitä, että reittejä muotoiluun ja arkkitehtuurin maailmaan on monia. Ja myös tietenkin sitä, miten valtavan monipuolinen se maailma on. Lisäksi tälle keväälle on luvassa muutama hyvin erityinen spesiaalijakso, joista lisää myöhemmin. Mutta nyt on kevään ensimmäinen jakso, ja me tavataan milanolaistunut, muotoiluun erikoistunut kirjoittaja, kuraattori, konsultti, opettaja, full disclaimer myös hyvä ystäväni, Anniina Koivu. Anniina Koivu, tervetuloa Helsinki Design Weeklyin.
Moi moi, kiitos.
And also in English, as we've agreed to switch languages, since English is your working language, a warm welcome to Helsinki Design Weekly studio, Anniina Koivu.
Thank you very much.
How are you today?
Excited. I've actually been here, not in this building, but to Radio Helsinki many, many years ago, maybe 15 years ago. Then we talked about architecture, but I don't remember the details.
We must see if we're able to find that episode somewhere in the archives.
Better not.
But you're in Helsinki now, even though you're based in Milan, Italy, and you also work in Lausanne in Switzerland. How did you end up moving there?
How did I end up? I think it all comes thanks to this one clever sentence. Once when I started studying architecture, I should actually start big rather than small, because in the very beginning I wasn't very clear whether it should be jewelry design, graphic design, fashion design. It just needed to be something creative. And then I have this weird memory that it was my grandfather, but time-wise that actually doesn't make sense. Anyway, there was a very wise person telling me to start big, because then you can actually go smaller. The other way around doesn't work. So that's why I did architecture in Dekoko. And for the last year, I got some sort of grant, picked Italy, picked Venice. But as I only had to do my final thesis, it was of course quite boring just to be in a city without any contact. So I inscribed into two courses. One was with Hans-Ulrich Obrist, and the other one was with Stefano Boeri. So at that moment, everything changed, because until that moment, I actually thought to become the next prize-winning architect. That didn't work out. But basically, I met two men who changed my life. One was Stefano, who gave me my first job, and the other one was Salvatore, who is still the father of my son.
Thank you for sharing this story. And knowing you today, I can understand, you know, I can see you making these decisions and just leaving and going to Venice, finding your own path in that way.
Yeah, it didn't play out the way I was thinking, but maybe I realized also that I'm not very good in doing these master schemes and sticking to them, because things just happen, and sometimes it's just good to go with the flow or take the occasion when it presents itself. So when Stefano became the director of Domus in Abitare magazine, he actually asked if I could become his design editor, with the explanation that within his crowd, I'm the only one who understands the small. Mm-hmm. So that was already the first step backwards, right? Towards the small from the big. And that was very exciting because obviously I didn't have any experience in working for a magazine or working in a design field. So I did a quite quick crash course and read everything I could read about it. We had a very good architecture history teacher in Decoco, so that was of help. And basically I was left on my own because he gave me a few recommendations. One was write about international design. Remember to mention sometimes the Italians. Don't do anything that would embarrass me. And if anyone asks you about a shop called Koivu in Helsinki, go with the flow. Because apparently there was a very legendary store in Milan, which was importing Scandinavian design. And it was called Koivu. I don't think the family behind it was also called like me. I think it was a abbreviation of their last name. But it had such an impact on Milan that a lot of people remembered that store. So that was sort of the nice entry into the design field in Milan.
The Trojan horse into conversation.
Yes, exactly.
I may or may not be involved with the shop. That's good. That's good. I know there might be some students listening. What would you tell them who might be dreaming of an international career and studying now?
Come to Lausanne. Mm. So, yeah, you mentioned that my time is, I split my time between Milan and Lausanne. I think I've been teaching in Lausanne already 13 years. It's a long time. So I run the theater, not the theater, right, the theory department at Ecole. Ecole is actually, so a few things people might not know. We who teach there are convinced that Ecole is the world's best design school. Sorry for Helsinki, but it is as it is. But what a lot of people don't know, it's actually a public school, so it doesn't cost much to study there. Of course, living in Switzerland is not a piece of cake, but if you compare it to London and maybe even to Helsinki, it's not that far away. And the facilities are amazing. And also because it's Lausanne, so it's not in, you know, it's not a capital like Paris or London or Milan and so on. The school has always made sure that great designers and practitioners who are in real life design business come and teach there. So for example, this year it's Erwan Bourolec who's running the diploma course, and we see how that goes. Submissions, I think, end next week. So a little bit of advertisement. Who wants to try? It's worth coming.
No, a little bit of advertisement is completely allowed. I know you also took your students to Fogo Island off the coast of Newfoundland in Canada. Is that something that you do often?
Oh, that is quite a long story, and I don't think we have the whole program to tell it. But basically, on Fogo Island, which is a tiny, the people living there in 11th and 12th generation call it a rock in the battered sea. It's actually closer to where the Titanic sank than to any other point. So there's this fisherman's island, which has gone through quite troubled times. People leaving the island, fishery declining, etc., etc. There's a foundation called the Shorefest Foundation, funded by Zita Kopp, who's one of these amazing people who have a mission, let's say so, who has decided to bring back and keep the life on the island. And she has done that in many different ways, from creating a hotel, creating a wood shop, creating arts residencies, etc. And I've been involved in a wood shop for quite a few years now. So we have developed a new collection of wooden furniture pieces, which hopefully speak also to an international audience rather than, let's say, only locally. And being in touch with the people of the island and having gone there quite a lot of times, it takes 24 hours to get there. We got this great
sorry,
idea.
What's the route from Lausanne to Fogo Island? 24 hours.
It means you have to go, let's say, for example, to Paris or London, from there to Toronto, Toronto, Halifax, Halifax, Gander. If you're lucky, you don't have to stay the night in Gander, but then you take 1 hour car ride and 1 hour ferry.
Mm, okay. Well, yeah, sorry.
It's long.
Just to give you an idea of where in the world we are. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, continue.
And so the occasion just presented itself that we could take a class of design students from Ecal there. In school, we have the summer universities, which kind of include trips around the world. So that's what we did. We went there for, I think, 10 days and studied the island from the point of view of wind, because, of course, it's a very windy place, as anyone can imagine. And the result is actually a series of wind turbines. Not that our students as designers rethink the turbine, because it's a very engineeristic project. So there were engineers involved as well. But let's say the perception of a wind turbine and how it sits in a landscape without becoming this hated object for so many people. And the turbines have traveled from different exhibitions to others. And actually, tomorrow is Friday, right? Tomorrow they are part of the show Transformers at the Vitra Design Museum, opening there.
Oh, wow. Are you planning a new similar project already, or will you continue with the Fogo Island?
I don't know. Fogo is magical. We have to wait a little bit because COVID was quite dramatic on the island as well. So they have to, I think, generate a little bit more again that the hotel starts running again, which besides the foundation is the biggest business on the island now. I hope it continues. There's so much to be done. And there are also a lot of projects which are still sort of on hold. So we managed to bring out beautiful collections with Anthony Gay and Wataru Kumanu, who is also quite known in Finland, as he has worked with Nikari.
Yes.
But yeah, we have a lot of other projects still on hold, which should see the light of the day.
As the head of master theory, what would you say, yeah, this might be an impossible question, but what would you say is the most important thing that you want to pass on to your students?
Have fun. I know it sounds so silly, but it's kind of an ongoing conversation that, of course, we have to work and we have to make a living. But I don't think a project is good if you don't have fun. And you do sometimes things out of the pleasure of doing it and not thinking of its economical output, for example. I think that's the most important thing. It might be contradictive sometimes, but if you don't feel it, you don't have the pleasure for it, I don't think it will be as good as it could be.
And I suppose just that is one of the purest joys of being a student, being able to explore in that space and trying to find the fun.
Exactly.
With exploring with one's practice or one's approach or just one's thinking.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the moment where you can go wild and also make mistakes, right? Later on, you get sort of afraid that you don't want to make too many of them because they might come back to you at some point. But even though it's fine to do mistakes later on as well. But yeah, as a student, I think we all remember it, that your imagination goes wild somehow, right? So yes, that should be cherished.
And as a teacher, you foster that, which is also a great responsibility.
Yeah, it can be. It can be. But then again, maybe it's important to note that at the Ecal we have BA and MA. I'm at the MA, so it means that the students we have already some background and experience. So in the best case, we actually take them out of their comfort zone and have them reflect on what they have done so far to kind of maybe redirect or re-navigate where their interests lie. So in most cases, the MA students who apply have also this wish to kind of stop for a moment and find their own language or find their expertise, their interest.
I can relate to that personally. I think for me, my master's was really a point of reflection and pausing and sort of rethinking and reforming my entire way of thinking and
exactly
working.
I mean, when would you have something like that happening later on? I guess you could take a sabbatical.
You could, but then...
Yeah.
You will not.
No, exactly. You sort of get into the routine, no? That one project leads into the next. So,
exactly.
Yeah, it would be great that everyone could go back to university at some point.
You're listening to Helsinki Design Weekly. It's Anni Korkman here today with Anniina Koivu.
Moi.
So it's nearly the end of March, And in the European design calendar or design world, this means that it's Salon del Mobile, Milan's Design Week, in a few weeks. Last year, one of your projects presented, there was this fantastic exhibition called A Prepper's Pantry, Objects That Save Lives. Who is a prepper?
I think we all are, to a certain extent, actually. Probably researching the topic has made at least everyone I know a prepper. So who is a prepper? A prepper is, typically we think of survivalists or the hoarders with the tinfoil hat hiding in the forest, right? There's a bit of comic in the idea of preppers. But if we look more carefully, the numbers, which are difficult to estimate, but it's said that there are about 20 million people who define themselves as preppers in the world. And numbers rising. So that also means that a lot of people who are sort of preparing for worse times, it doesn't mean that you have to prepare immediately for apocalypse, right? But that you take care of yourself and your beloved ones for harder times. I think that is sort of part of everybody. I mean, even in Finland, if you consider that summers are spent with preparing wood and food for the winter, it sort of comes natural to the human beings. Why we made an exhibition about preppers is sort of a different story. It was, by now a year and a half ago. It went the other way around that it usually goes. I had insured a space, which basically was a tunnel within Drop City. So it's called a tunnel, even though you can't actually go through it, but it has this sort of dark underground bunker-style atmosphere to it.
Aren't they like the railway arches?
Exactly. They're under the central station in Milan. And so any kind of exhibition that was going in there had to be either in tune or in contrast. So either it was something fluffy and pink, or it was something more closer to the space or its atmosphere. And then reading about just simply New York Times, The New Yorker, any kind of international newspaper, it kind of came out that there's this growing trend for preparedness. So whether it's the high-tech people from Silicon Valley, people buying new land in New Zealand, which is supposed to be one of the safest areas in the world, et cetera, et cetera. It sort of became a theme. It kind of came out of the newspaper that there was something. And especially nobody had looked at the scene of preparedness through design. So what are the objects that anyone should have? And in the exhibition in Milan, we created this pantry that you could step into, and it was organized basically like a supermarket. So everything you need to have to at least survive 72 hours or something more, going from water, food, hygiene, medicine, shelter, warmth, coolness sometimes as well, transportation, navigation, tools, etc., etc. So it's the basic categories that we can imagine you will need to cover in case that you're on your own. Another thing maybe important to mention is that preppers exist in many cases as a kind of counter movement to institutional and governmental help. Because, of course, there's all kinds of rescues. Every government is taking care of, in a case of emergency, to come and rescue its people. But it's also officially said that this might take 72 hours. So, you know, it could be that you are on your own for 72 hours, whether you're in your own apartment or on the move, for example. And for these 72 hours, it's actually a recommendation for everyone to have a sort of, it's called BOB, the B-O-B, the bug out of bag, ready next to the door. So that has, you know, the essentials, the essential human needs just by the door. Anyway, it started digging into this this topic. It just became bigger and bigger and bigger. And last year in Milan, we made this pantry, which was sort of a teaser into our broader research that we're working on now. And it will be shown, I think, on 1,000 square meters. It's huge. It's just getting bigger all the time. Well, basically, we're taking over the entire museum of MUDAC in Lausanne in September.
That's a big exhibition space, by the way.
I know. It's going to be great.
Well, I had the joy of visiting Drop City, the first
pantry exhibition, and it did make me think, since, as you mentioned, there is this, I don't know, like an individualist spin toward, like, in this whole movement of prepping, because there is might be some mistrust towards the government's ability to take care of us, and yet at the same time, what I took of it is that there is this, like, a deep knowledge sharing community where people recommend the best pantry essentials to take with you, or even test their ability to really protect you, that makes us find the best possible products to save our lives. And another thing which I thought of after visiting is that, can one blame these preppers today, as there is a constant sort of threat of a catastrophe or like disasters looming over us for decades already? It's not a new movement.
No, it's it occurred the first time in print about 100 years ago. That's when the term prepper appeared. It said that it came about more or less the moment of the Wall Street crash in 29, when maybe a certain uncertain moment presented itself. But in the exhibition, as in the entire topic, I think we have to be careful that it goes from healthy preparedness to extreme, which also involves conspiracy and a kind of diverted view onto the world. So we have to be very careful in that, saying that, you know, it's not them and they're all bad, because it has a lot of positive aspects to it as well, to be prepared for an emergency, for example. But, you know, there's the thin line where it stays healthy, for example. And then also, if you consider that natural disasters have existed ever since planet Earth exists, right? Volcanoes have erupted, there's floods, there's winds, and so on and so on. But if you look at the timeline, we can see that certain disasters, especially those human-made and human-accelerated, have increased. Of course, that's related to pollution and to hazards and accidents and incidents. So we're not even looking at war. We're looking at sort of natural phenomena. So it is somehow understandable that a certain fear is increasing. But then on the other hand, I do believe that if we address anything like this with sort of a natural human understanding that, you know, you react the right way, you help each other, there's a great sense of resilience and community resilience, then things are not that bad. And what's really interesting, we have been reading up these kind of books by Solnit, Rebecca Solnit, or Hannah Ritchie. Hannah Ritchie has a fantastic book called It's Not the End of the World. So she actually bases her studies on data, which shows that there is optimism if we act. And all these kind of topics play into the show as well.
Yes. There is a great hopeful tone to the project, which can be experienced. I know your research is taking you around the world.
Yes.
As it is a global phenomenon, of course, and people prep and prepare themselves in different ways. Since we are in Helsinki at the moment, I think now is a good time to announce what has brought you to Helsinki at this time.
Yeah, it's a good coincidence. We just ended filming with Tapio Snellman, who I hope a lot of you guys know. He is a brilliant filmmaker in the architectural field. So documenting buildings and built environments. Because in the exhibition, we have various case studies. One of them is Helsinki, the Helsinki Underground Master Plan, which is quite unique. So if you consider that ever since the Second World War, from the US onwards, bunkers have been built everywhere. Switzerland has an enormous amount of bunker space. They have, I think, almost a million more places than they actually have inhabitants. Like in Finland as well, the idea of Väestösuoja, yeah, it's part of basically every residential or public building that you do have something underground. The difference between, for example, Switzerland and Helsinki is that many of the underground spaces in Helsinki are developed and considered as part of also the overground master plan. So we can talk about a 3D master plan. What we did over the last days in Helsinki is to visit the public areas and basically document how underground is part of everyday life. So we went to the skate park in Kontula, to a Formula Kart center. There's a church, there's the Vapaantaitentila underground. What else did we do? Now I keep on forgetting. We had like a list of 15 spots.
We went to the swimming pool, Itis.
Yes, yeah, we went to Itäkeskuksen swimming pool, which is cut into rock, of course. All kinds of metro stations. And there was one thing which was really cool, but now I don't remember. I think maybe the skate park was one of the best.
Oh, yeah. And then the quiet. Did you mention
the formula card?
The formula card.
Yeah, we did that too. No, it was all very, very exciting to see what is actually happening underground, I have to say. In the good and in the bad. I mean, it's nice to see that these are part of everyday life, especially if the weather is as it has been in recent days. You know, you can't really do many things above ground. Especially, exactly, that was the cool one, Olympia Stadion.
Oh, yes, of course.
Exactly, yeah, with the running tracks down there. I personally don't know if I would go running down there, because after all, you are underground, you are in the dark, and you, of course, you perceive it that you are cut off from fresh air and or from natural light.
Even though the ceiling is quite high, though.
Yes.
On that specific running track that we're referring
to. And it did have something meditating to it, because, you know, you don't get distracted somehow. Mm. And it was very nicely designed, the entire underground, and renovated also the entire stadium.
It was very expensive as well.
Well, they did a good job
with
the money.
I know. Yeah, we did an exhibition there a few years ago for Helsinki Design Week, and it's absolutely worth visiting.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, for everyone, really.
Yes.
Exactly. So anyway, we went around Helsinki and documented, I think, 16 of different underground spaces, and Tapio will edit it into a short movie, and that will be then on show.
Mm. I'm really... really pleased about this coincidence as one of the reasons, or one of the one of the reasons of Helsinki Design Weekly's existence is that we are able to show Helsinki from new perspectives, and just giving our listeners this sort of note that whenever you're using these underground spaces, or even if you just walk past them, they are there and they can be accessed by anyone.
Yeah. Isn't that also a topic for your next Helsinki Design Week?
Yes.
Tell us more.
Well, thank you. Underneath Pinnanalla is the annual theme of Helsinki Design Week. And even though we are not, literally going underground, it does have that that same thematic, encouragement to just look a bit deeper and look
behind. A bit closer.
Yeah, look a bit closer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very good.
Exactly. Thank you. I do have to go back to the prepping movement. Research is now in progress. How do you foresee the project developing in the coming months? Where are you going to next?
Travels haven't been confirmed yet. I would love to go to the US, actually. I would love to go to a place like Idaho, like the Northwest.
Why Idaho?
It's very geeky, but so there's the World Risk Index, which establishes the areas which are safest or prone to disaster. Idaho and sort of the surroundings are among the safest. So that has made a whole prepper culture actually move to Idaho. So much so that it has become a political force. I think it would be just interesting to understand what's happening. And also, it sounds a bit counterproductive, right? As a prepper, you would want to get out of society, whereas they seem to be kind of ganging up again. I would love to see that. I would love to go to Utah, because apparently Mormons are the greatest, world's greatest producers of food with long life. Do you say life expectancy? Well, those long shelf life.
Oh, you mean like tinned food?
Yeah, tin or dried food.
Oh, yeah, dried, yeah.
So in Milan in the exhibition, we had a bucket which was called the entree breakfast bucket. I mean, it sounds so chic. Really, it was a plastic bucket with, I think, 60 servings of anything from mashed potatoes to macaroni and cheese, etc. Don't know why it was called breakfast. And apparently they last 35 years.
What?
I know. So it would be just interesting to go and find out more about it. We didn't dare to open it. But no, that's really, we didn't open it because it needs to go to the Lausanne exhibition as well.
And you have to wait like 35 years to really test it. Yeah.
Maybe we do a dinner in the museum then in Lausanne.
Oh, yeah. That'd
serving.
That'd be great. Some mac and cheese for breakfast. As far as I'm aware, the impact of the preppers movement on design and architecture hasn't really been explored before you and your team. What can designers learn from preppers?
Oh, that's such a nasty question.
Sorry.
What can they learn? Well, in the exhibition, we show things which are just weird. Mm. So that's good. But in many cases, they are just very functional things. Mm. So even though we select things also for, of course, their looks and aesthetics and that they're, you know, well-designed pieces, but foremost, they need to function. Mm. If you're in front of a choice that you can only take as much as you can carry, for example, you might not take the things that are superfluous at some point, right? Nevertheless, it's said that you should have some sort of memorabilia, even if it's just a keychain with the photos of the family or something like that. So, you know, psychology and memory and so on are also important. Nevertheless, the most functional pieces probably will serve you the best. Mm. And if you want to know what's the one piece...
Yes, yes, that's my next question.
It's a knife.
Mm.
With a knife, you can do anything. So it can be the Swiss knife, but in the show we will actually bring together the 22 pieces that in 2010 Simo Heikkilä put together. I don't know if you remember the Leuku project.
Yes.
So he invited national and international designers to rethink the traditional Leuku knife.
Puukko.
And we're bringing those 22 back together for the show, which is quite exciting. That's because in general, the knife will serve you any purpose. Mm.
Exactly. So welcome back. My name is still Anni Korkman, and today I have design writer, curator and teacher Anniina Koivu keeping me company here in Radio Helsinki studio.
Hello again.
Hello again. So we've talked about your teaching work at Ecole. We've talked about the traveling exhibition and ongoing research preppers project that includes the most practical objects humans have come up with. Talking about utilitarian basics, I think now it's time to mention one of your other projects, which is the Koivu jumper.
Yeah.
What is a Koivu jumper?
It's the best jumper a person can have.
It really is, I have to say. Yeah.
It's actually I'm very good speaking about other people's work. Speaking actually about my own project is a bit more complicated. There's not so much to say about it. It is just a very good jumper, 100% extra fine merino. It should last a lifetime. As a friend from fashion said, it's washable, which is a big thing as well. So basically it is, imagine a sweatshirt in cotton, but then turned with raglan sleeves, sort of baggy, into wool. Well, you know, you are wearing it every day.
I am wearing mine every day. And again, maybe some advertisement is allowed, but it really is the perfect jumper. And I know it's quite self-explanatory to say it's just a really, really good villapaita. It's unisex, it's relaxed fit. I know it's the result of careful study of this archetypical form. I just want to talk about it, even though there is... I mean, yeah, it's just a really good jumper that you can buy from your online store at koivu.it. But I just know that there is so much research, and I know that you've had your Anniina Koivu approach to this jumper as well, which makes me curious to hear more about it.
for example, I know you use it for a canvas for experiments.
Yes.
What does that mean? How can a jumper be a canvas for experiments?
Well, it did start as just one product, which already makes it sort of different from the fashion field that I keep on being asked, what is a product? It's, you know, it's a fashion item. But yeah, it is just one jumper in four different sizes. And we started with monocolors and thought that we would just continue with the same in changing or adding colors. So it's not even seasonal. We just add colors when there's the right moment to do so. But obviously, I'm not saying that became boring, but we realized that there's more to a simple jumper as well. So we started working, collaborating with other designers and artists. Our first collaboration is with Giulio Ridolfo, who is a color expert working in textiles with Quadrat, etc. And he's helping us to sort of dissect now the jumper into its four yarns and create new colors, which are, or new colorways, which are the combination of individual colors. So up to four we can do. And then the canvas idea came from having the basic jumper also in this white color, which does look like a painting canvas. And I invited eight artists and designers. So there's Brynja Sigurðsson from Iceland. There's a graffiti artist from Naples. There is Foss, the Danish artist. There's Ryo Kobayashi, Japanese-Austrian designer who lives in London, etc. So it's quite varied. Oh, Christoph Hefti, who actually worked for 20 years for Dries Van Noten, and I managed to kind of bring him back into fashion for a little moment. We gave the jumper to these people, and they created a drawing, basically, which we then embroidered on top of it. So that was an exhibition. And we just went to Paris to the Fashion Week there to a showroom to show the jumper. So we'll see what happens. Now it's the next big move.
I have to ask, what is the next big move for the Koiva jumper?
Well, the next big move should be to land maybe a handful of shops internationally, the right shops who can carry it. For example, in Helsinki, we don't have any. We had a Glasshouse when it existed, but of course the pop-up ended a few years ago. So I think it makes sense to have the jumper, especially in Scandinavia, because it's an all-year-round jumper, right? It keeps the cold wind out, but it doesn't make you hot. But
no, then any summer... It's basically the summer uniform.
Here. Yeah, exactly. In the evenings in the summer, you do need it, after all. And the next big move is sort of to understand that we exist now since a year and a half, 2 years more or less, and I think we have saturated the area, the circle of friends and friends and friends, so we need to make the move to kind of get out there and reach other people, which can be done through communication, which we're still trying to figure out how to do that best. Happy to have some help and advice. And the other one is to have these stores. But then getting stores on board, it makes a kind of different shift, because at some point, there's this question of margins as well. If we want to do a jumper which is honestly priced and we don't have the marketing expenses, but then if a retailer comes into it, the calculation doesn't add up. So we have to find a kind of honest middle ground. And I think that's the next challenge we have to do.
And we'll take some more research, I would imagine.
Yeah, again. Exactly.
Yes. I do love the idea of an archetype of a piece of clothing, and indeed I'm a huge fan. I have the jumper in navy blue and also the creamy white. Will you also make some trousers? Maybe a jacket?
I don't think so. No. There might be a hoodie. Yeah, I know. We keep on talking about it. One thing I can say that we're experimenting with knitted linen, which we manage because it's very difficult, but we have to work still on the shape of it. But if that works out, then we also have the summer version for the southern part of Europe.
Mm. Oh, perfect. our time is unfortunately coming to end, but the essential last question will be, what's next for Annina Koivu? What are you dreaming about?
Oh, I have no clue. Right now I'm dreaming about being at the summer house. But I don't know. I like the idea to do projects which are not so long. Mm. I think working on a deadline is always good. And that also is a bit of a criticism towards institutions and museums, that things are just planned on such a long run that at some point it feels like the air is kind of deflating. I don't know. I'm playing with the idea of a temporary museum or a pop-up museum. Let's see if that works out. So then we do that next year in Milan.
And I will look forward to that. Thank you so much, Anniina Koivu, for coming to Helsinki Design Weekly as the first special guest of this spring.
Kiitoksia paljon.
Kiitos. And thank you for listening. This was Helsinki Design Weekly, which is also, by the way, a weekly newsletter that you can subscribe to at helsinkidesignweek.com. Hei, kiitos paljon kuulijoille. Kiitos siitä, että olitte siellä linjoilla toisessa päässä. Kiitos kaikille työkavereille täällä Radio Helsingissä ja Helsinki Design Weekillä sekä tietenkin ohjelman kumppaneille Grafialle, Arkkitehtuuri- ja Designmuseolle. Jatketaan jostakin muotoiluun liittyvästä aiheesta ensi viikolla. Loppuun kuunnellaan vielä Anniinan viimeinen toivebiisi, joka on Jamiroquain Too Young to Die.